Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, July 20th, 2015. The frequent FOIA filer Jason Leopold is featured on the front page of the New York Times today. And according to the paper of record, the so-called Gray Lady, Jason Leopold listens to soothing music like this by Slayer as he composes his challenges to various agencies of the federal government under the Freedom of Information Law. And I am delighted to see Jason get this recognition. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know that Jason appears here on a regular basis. He's working at Vice News. He is a dogged investigative reporter. And he confesses that he's kind of a pretty rageful guy. A reporter named Ravi Somaya profiles Leopold and his Freedom of Information Act efforts in this powerful story. The print edition of the paper featured the headline, "The, quote, rageful guy, end quote, who pries secrets from the government." The online headline, which is a little milder, says, "A wizard at prying government secrets from the government." And I'll link to this article so you can savor it in every detail for yourselves. But I am delighted that Jason, who is quite an individual, he loves to wear T-shirts that favor heavy metal bands like Slayer and Pantera. And one time, Jason favored me. He dropped about 10 or 11, maybe even more, CDs, each chock full of tunes from his personal collection. And he and I have tastes that do overlap. Mine don't extend as far as Slayer and Pantera because I was a heavy metal DJ in the 1980s and I got over it. But I'm just so happy to see him get this recognition. And even some of his competitors are quoted from the Washington Post. Adam Goldman says, "Every time I have a FOIA, I think nobody's come across. He seems to already have a piece of it." And I don't know exactly how many requests that Leopold has pending. But there are 715,000 Freedom of Information Act requests that were filed in 2014. I don't know exactly how many of those have Jason Leopold's signature on them. At any rate, Leopold, who has always been candid about his previous problems with cocaine, he revealed that in his tell-all memoir called News Junkie. And his drug problems led him to steal CDs back in the day, and he ended up being a drug felon. And despite his background, because of his extreme honesty, I've always trusted Jason Leopold. And while the article doesn't go into detail, it does refer to some of these scandals that have touched Jason Leopold, including one that is blandly called improper sourcing here. And that has to do with the time that he wrote a dispatch for truthout.org, reporting that Karl Rove had in fact been indicted in the Scooter Libby case. Now, I believe Jason. I think there was an indictment. I think it was filed, and I think it was purged. We may never know the truth of that, but I know Jason did get burned in that episode. So he's quoted by the Times, "You know, I love the score, so maybe there's this druggish thing in me that still exists. Maybe that was always part of my personality. I love the score, particularly when it's from the government." And the article describes how every day when he goes to his mailbox, Leopold looks for his latest package from a government agency and drops everything like a kid on Christmas morning to open it up and see what he's gotten. Now, the article curiously doesn't talk about any of his testimony before the Government Oversight Committee. When was that? Back in early June or late May? And I am disappointed that the Times didn't note that, because I think Jason provided some very important testimony there. But it really feels good to see the corporate media's leading organ pay tribute on its front page to our friend and colleague, Jason Leopold. I've linked to, in case I didn't mention, I've linked to it so you can read the article for yourselves. Now we turn to the various claims that people are making about the man accused of the shooting that killed now five military recruiters in Chattanooga, Tennessee last week. And when I look at my Facebook page, I've got it up here right now. Here's a post from my buddy Matt Gray in Sacramento, who just flatly says, "Our country has suffered another domestic terrorist attack, and our military personnel have been murdered. Why are our flags not at half-mast?" Now, for the deaths of these service members, I would support flying the flags at half-staff. I do not believe that this is a case of terrorism or domestic terrorism. And as I reported on Friday, I'm hugely skeptical of so many of these cases because I've seen the proof that the FBI frames people. It inserts paid informants and provocateurs who provide the means for a crime to people who otherwise wouldn't have it. And so I'm very skeptical, and I know that so many of these so-called domestic terrorism cases are fraudulent, or at least tainted by the use of paid informants and other legal shortcuts. So on Friday, I told you that for me, it's a little surprising, but it appears that the suspect who was killed in the shootout, Muhammad Abdulaziz, may not have been targeted by the FBI. FBI says they didn't know about this guy, didn't have a trail on him, didn't know that he went to Jordan last year, which is where his family, he has family there. He's variously described as a Palestinian who came here via Jordan or Kuwait. At least his parents did. And so on Facebook, in response to that, there's some pretty ugly comments. Like Raymond here, who posts, "I think the government doesn't want to acknowledge that it's a big thing due to investigations." Eric says, "I've seen some patriotic businesses and even a few government agencies lower them flags. Obama is no patriot. He was a big mistake that ignorant people made twice." Then we have Chris. "We can fly the flag half-staff because a dog that belonged to a president died, but not when our military personnel are gunned down on home soil." And then Teresa. "Maybe when Obama gets back from his family vacation in New York, which he left for after our soldiers were gunned down. From what I have read, he hasn't even called the families of the fallen soldiers. Get him out of here already." And then Judy posts, this is pretty wild, "Because the man Obama is part of the group who murdered them." So we have in this country now a reflexive sense of that if somebody with a Muslim surname kills people, including uniformed military members who were on duty, they were not in a combat zone, they were in a recruiting office, that people just say, well, that must be terrorism. We have General Wesley Clark, who has postured as a progressive, and he went public today saying that he thinks that anyone who is found to be supporting terrorists should essentially be rounded up and quarantined or interned. Well, from what we know, the FBI has found no evidence that he's tied to any foreign terrorist organization, despite his visits to the Middle East. And the only real evidence that supports any sense that this was a terrorist act is that he did send an email or a text message to a friend before he began his rampage. And he quoted an Islamic verse saying, "Whosoever shows enmity to a friend of mine, then I have declared war against him." But from what the family has told us, these appear to be the ravings of a deeply depressed and troubled and a young man who turned to drugs. And they sent him to Jordan for the summer last year to get him away from druggy friends and to get him off drugs. And most people immediately said, oh, he was in Jordan last year. He must have been training with the Islamic State. There is zero evidence to support that at this point. And if there is evidence that supports it, I'll tell you. I'm not going to hide it. I'm not invested in keeping the FBI as this rogue agency that never does anything right. But when we hear people just immediately jump to conclusions that this is a terrorist act and it should be treated that way, well, I invite you to listen to my interview that we posted last week with Faiza Patel of New York University's Brennan Center on the Law. We talked about the episode in Charleston, South Carolina, and whether that is a case of domestic terrorism. And we note that it goes beyond just mere labeling, that we now use the term terrorism to justify unconstitutional, extra-legal maneuvers in law enforcement. And so Glenn Greenwald wrote a powerful post, and I'm linking to that in the show file for the podcast today, too, where he breaks this down. And he said, look, terrorism is defined as some kind of violent act against a civilian. And he said these were soldiers in uniform. They were not civilians. And therefore, this is not terrorism as it is defined. It's not violence against civilians. And so I invite you to read his lawyerly dissertation or dissection of these issues, because I consider this very important. And as I bring up the next item here in my stack, we have Congressman Michael McCaul, a Republican who chairs the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives. He flatly says, without providing any new evidence and in contradiction of what is out there, that this was a terrorist attack in Chattanooga and that the FBI had busted or defused over 60 would-be terrorist attacks by ISIS followers in the last year. Now, McCaul requires no evidence to call this Abdulaziz gentleman, 24-year-old young man, a terrorist. But he doesn't offer any evidence to support his claim of over 60 plots that were somehow busted up. And this is what we're seeing, this kind of propaganda, where they seize on an event like this, and by all accounts, this is a deranged lone wolf who happened to be Muslim, who happened to target soldiers. But the hysteria that proceeds from this is part of the ugly problem that we've seen in this country since 9/11. The term terrorism is used to justify things that were off the books before 9/11. Flatly unconstitutional, illegal based on our laws. But now none of that matters. You play the terrorism card, you can do anything. You could waterboard somebody, right? That's the mentality. So McCaul, conflating different events, says, well, what they are saying is to attack military installations and police officers. This is ISIS giving directions from Syria to people in the United States. He said, the new threat that's out there over the internet, it's very hard to stop. We have 200,000 ISIS tweets a day that hit the United States. The chatter is so loud and the volume is so high that it's a problem. It's very hard to stop and disrupt in this country, and it's something we've been warning about this last year. Unfortunately, we saw it happen in Chattanooga. See how he does that? That's called conflation. And it's going on a lot these days. And I have to ding the Guardian. That's the source of the article that I'm looking at here. Because they tie these various alleged domestic terrorism events now, including Chattanooga, to the provocative event in Garland, Texas, back in May, where these anti-Islamic activists in this country staged a provocation, and two Muslim men drove over from Phoenix and took the bait and shot up the competition to draw the Prophet Muhammad. Now, you can narrowly define that as a terrorist event because Muslims went from Phoenix to Texas and tried to kill some people, some civilians. But this was not some plot that was directed from Syria. And it basically just excises the reason why it occurred. It was brought on by ugly, angry white people who were looking for a fight, and they got one. Well, the battle of the summer will be over the nuclear deal with Iran. And on Friday, it didn't get much news, but President Obama called Bibi Netanyahu and offered him cash. Now, I want to be clear, he's not trying to buy Netanyahu's silence. There doesn't appear to be any deal that will give Israel more money to buy military hardware if they stand down in their opposition to the nuclear deal. Nope, we're not buying anything from Israel. We're just giving them more money. We're going to jack up the amount that we give them every year by about $1 billion or $1.5 billion. And I'm really offended by this. Because we have no business funding Israel's military to begin with. And to say that because we have at least put off the threat that Israel, you know, perceives as an existential threat from Iran, we have bought at least 10 years, if not 15, of peace. But Israel can't stand for that. They want to scuttle the deal. And regardless of what happens with the Iranian deal, we're going to be giving more money to Israel to buy military hardware, mostly from the United States. And we are fueling the arms race in the Middle East. That same arms race is one of the talking points that the Israeli supporters offer in opposition to the Iranian deal. They say, yeah, it's going to stoke an arms race. Well, when we give more weapons to Israel, we have to give more weapons to Saudi Arabia. And it is an endless escalating cycle. The deal with Iran offered us an opportunity to pause that cycle, and we're not taking it. Over at the UN, the Security Council unanimously approved a resolution creating the basis for international economic sanctions against Iran to be lifted. Furious reaction from Israel. Angry showdown ahead in Congress. The vote was 15-0. And I think that this is an important step forward. Over the weekend, the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, he gave a talk that people interpret as his veiled support for the deal. He's not always explicit, and I think I understand that. But the way observers interpret it, he didn't say he's against it. Therefore, we can conclude that he is for it. And now come the people who want to scuttle the deal. This is a fascinating story here that I want to air out a little bit for you. You know about AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It is a very unusual organization. It is a foreign lobby. And as such, it's technically illegal under American law. But because it's AIPAC and because they support Israel, we look the other way. Now, to avoid rocking the boat so much that AIPAC would be defined publicly and legally as a foreign lobby, they have formed a new group with the Orwellian name Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran, with the sole mission of educating the public about the dangers of the proposed deal. Here are their talking points. The deal increases the chances of war, will spur a nuclear arms race, and rewards Iran despite its horrific human rights record. Those are the official talking points. You're going to hear them over and over again all summer long. And the idea that a peace deal with Iran spurs an arms race is just so ludicrous as to defy description. Now, get this. There are heavy hitters who used to be members of the United States Senate. And they're mostly Democrats. You have to decide whether you think Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who was a Democrat and then became an independent, and then, he's always been a Republican in my mind. but he hung on to his Senate seat in Connecticut after a big challenge from Ned Lamont. I've got Ned's bumper sticker over here, rebranded himself as an independent. And Lieberman has always been more loyal to Israel than the United States, in my view. And along with him, Evan Bayh, former senator from Indiana, Mark Begich, former senator from Alaska, and Mary Landrieu, the former senator from oil and gas and also Louisiana. Now, these are all people who can be bought. They are centrist to right-center Democrats, and their loyalty to Israel, in my view, is clearer than their loyalty to the United States. And they are going to be supporting AIPAC's effort, this Orwellian Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran. They'll be the front people. They'll be lobbying members of Congress. There's no mention here of whether they're being paid. And whether or not they're being paid, I think it's disloyal to side with a foreign country in a struggle against a president of your own party. These are amazing times. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Linda Gray, Aaron Blair, Steve Wozenski, and Judy Holloway. They're all monthly subscribers who just kicked in the last few days, and I appreciate your support. My hosting bill just came due, and we're going to pay that in the next few days with money coming from subscribers like you. And I invite you to join the ranks. I need more people to support this. Keep it all going. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a link under my picture. It says sign up. Takes you to the page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. You can make a one-time contribution. You can get the mailing address to use a check or a money order or cash if you don't want to use PayPal. The best deal is the $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers get a bonus gift, an ebook copy of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. The singular greatest foreign policy achievement so far of the Obama administration is the effort to end the failed embargo and isolation of Cuba. And today, in an important step forward, the United States officially reopened its six-story embassy in Havana, and the Cuban interest section in Washington was rechristened as the Cuban Embassy. Still remains to be seen whether Congress will lift the sanctions, the trade embargo. And, of course, Marco Rubio, who wants to be president, he has said that he will roll back. He'll turn back the hands of time, and he will roll back Obama's improved relations with Cuba if he is elected president next year. We have a new WikiLeaks revelation, this showing how the NSA monitored the activities and the communications of Germany's foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Steinmeier apparently was being monitored all the way back to 1998. And this is a critical intercept because NSA was reporting on a meeting that Steinmeier had with Condoleezza Rice, who was then Secretary of State, November 29, 2005. And in a moment, I will quote from this intercept the information that was really important to the United States, but you need to know the backdrop here. At issue was the U.S. overflying the airspace of European allies on our kidnap missions, the so-called renditions or torture taxis. We know that some of those prisoners were delivered to places like a black site in Poland. Some were shipped to places where we could rely on torture being applied, like Syria and Egypt. And one of the people we picked up was a German national named Khalid El-Masri. And we picked up the wrong guy named El-Masri, but we didn't admit it until we had tortured this guy, flown him many spots around the world. And when we finally figured out we had the wrong guy, we just dropped him in the middle of nowhere in Romania late one night. And so Steinmeier is reported to have been relieved that he didn't get a definitive response from Condoleezza Rice regarding reports of CIA flights through Germany to secret prisons in Eastern Europe. And this reminds me of Sergeant Schultz in the old POW comedy Hogan's Heroes. I see nothing. I know nothing. And I like it that way. And so this is the wink and nod game that the U.S. played with its allies. We'll pretend you don't know that we're overflying your airspace to kidnap people without your knowledge or permission. And you'll pretend that you don't know. And I have to say, WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, they've done us some big favors in providing the obvious truth in many of these cases. Today, I'm releasing an in-depth interview to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And if it's not too self-aggrandizing, I am declaring today that the partisan lockdown on honest criticism of Obamacare is over. The Republicans will not succeed in repealing the law. The Supreme Court has twice ruled that despite bad drafting, they're going to leave the law in place. And so now we can kind of ratchet down from the partisan skirmishing where we weren't allowed to acknowledge the weaknesses, the severe flaws in Obamacare because it would only inflame the obstructionist Republicans and, you know, give them momentum. What did they introduced 47 different bills to repeal Obamacare in the House in the last few years. And so I'm declaring that that's behind us, and now we can honestly look at what's wrong with Obamacare. And Trudy Lieberman, a veteran journalist who writes a lot for the Columbia Journalism Review, has the cover story in Harper's Magazine July issue. It's called Wrong Prescription, the Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. And if you listen to our in-depth interview, you're going to hear honest criticism of the shortcomings of this bill, the pro-corporate agenda, the profit-taking from insurance companies, the huge increases that are threatened for the coming year. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with journalist Trudy Lieberman.
So you've got consumer advocacy groups giving all this sort of standard advice. Well, call the plan, call your doctor. Well, you know, that only goes so far because some of the plans drop the doctors and some of the doctors don't know which plans they're in or their staffs don't know which plans they're in. And it's becoming a very big bureaucratic mess. One could argue the typical old-fashioned consumer solution would have been, let's pass a law, and we'll pass a law, and we'll be able to help people out. Well, maybe to some degree you can. But basically, this is a limiting of choice, and choice was one of the big reasons for the passage of the law. Remember, you can keep your doctor. That's what the president told us. Well, you can't keep your doctor. And now the mantra from many of these groups is that, well, you know, you're just going to have to make choice. You want to pay more money for a wide-open network and go to the best or the most expensive, but not necessarily the best, but right. Maybe most expensive cancer treatment centers in your area, which tend to be eliminated in some of these narrow networks, or a very expensive children's hospital, for example. That's mm-hmm. another one that's often not in. Or do you want to pay a lower premium? And I don't think that's what people bargained for when this law was being passed. I don't think they knew anything about it. They remembered the slogans, they're going to get affordable quality health care, and the president promised $2,500 savings for every family. Perhaps you remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that some people did lose their coverage. The Republicans were not entirely wrong here. Some people did lose their coverage, and they yeah. lost what they thought was good coverage for them. And you know, that had to happen because of the minimum benefit standards that all these new policies had. But I think this narrow network problem is really beginning to be an issue because it is limiting people and it's sticking them with some very expensive bills that they hadn't bargained on.
I invite you to listen to the full conversation with Trudy Lieberman. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at Stitcher, at TuneIn, and at iTunes, wherever else you find our podcasts. A couple of items from over the weekend. It's very curious that Republicans, many of whom remained silent when Donald Trump was sliming Mexicans and many other groups, they have this selective outrage. And it was stupid for Trump to call out John McCain, saying he was not a war hero because my heroes don't get captured. Well, Trump sat out the Vietnam War, and he has no business or basis to criticize McCain. Now, if you look at the real story about John McCain, there are honest questions about his military service, but not really about his role as a prisoner of war. And so we have Republicans who are growing more and more queasy about the Trump juggernaut. And I'm happy to see that. But he has license to go after non-citizens, minorities, other nationalities. And when he crosses the line, it's when he steps on the legacy of a Republican who's not widely loved but is generally revered by members of his own party. And if you didn't see it, one of the best pieces about the Donald was by Frank Bruni in Sunday's op-ed section, The Week in Review in the New York Times, where he compares him to the former leader of Italy, Silvio Berlusconi. And the only thing that Trump is missing, he's got the money, he's got the arrogance, he has all that self-promotion that he loves to dish out. But he needs some underage hookers like Berlusconi. And he needs to throw some bada bing parties or what? I can't remember. There's an Italian exclamation that was used to describe his sex parties. Also, over the weekend at Netroots Nation, which is held in Phoenix this year, there was an incident that drew quite a bit of press coverage. And before I dive into it, I'll tell you, I've been to Netroots Nation twice. The most recent was 2 years ago in San Jose, where Nancy Pelosi got booed by the group over her comments about Ed Snowden, if I recall correctly. So this is Netroots Nation is an offshoot of the Daily Kos. It's all Democratic Party operatives, younger, more internet-focused, digital. These are the wunderkind who are hired to run campaigns in this country. And I don't have anything against Netroots Nation, but I found that it was, it's populated by people who just want to win, baby, and have less linkage to principles. So on Saturday, both Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland running for Democratic nomination for president, and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont made separate appearances at Netroots Nation. Both were moderated by Jose Antonio Vargas, the journalist who is an undocumented immigrant. So a woman interrupted his conversation with O'Malley. Her name is Tia Oso of the Black Immigration Network. And she got up and lectured Martin O'Malley about how Black lives matter. And O'Malley tried to be a good sport and work along with it, tried to answer the questions, but then the audience started to heckle him and to boo him. And he ended up making a statement as he ran from the stage, saying, yes, Black lives matter and white lives matter and every life matters. Well, that then was the basis of an attack on O'Malley for essentially watering down the impact of Black Lives Matter by saying that all lives matter. Now, politically, that's not a smart thing to do. I understand that. But this becomes more like a Tea Party mentality or chemistry. And while I think her message was important, and I will acknowledge that Tia Oso got both candidates to change their stump speeches to include more about police brutality and about the inequities that face African Americans. But it's ironic that they would heckle and boo and interrupt and treat rudely two people who arguably have the best record on race relations in this country of the 19 or 20 people who are running for president next year from both parties. And so, while I understand what drove this, I'm sympathetic to the sense that our political machinery doesn't address these issues properly. To stage this just days after Obama went to a federal prison and has launched this great initiative to address the disparities in criminal prosecution and incarceration in this country. And rather than build on that and challenge O'Malley and Sanders to say what they would do to extend Obama's effort on criminal justice reform, I think they just made everybody look bad, and I don't think anybody gains from that. And finally, I find this truly bizarre. There is a new hacker group that has surfaced, and it calls itself the Impact Team. And while my first reaction to this is a bunch of Bible thumpers trying to impose a puritanical view, that may not be the case. So these hackers have breached the security of a website that specializes in hooking up people who want to have extramarital affairs. It's called AshleyMadison.com. I've heard of it. I went and visited there one time. I'm not a member, and so my data is not at risk of being compromised. So I don't have any stake in this, okay? But I was stunned to learn that Ashley Madison has 37 million members who are hankering to get naked and roll around with somebody they currently don't know. So Ashley Madison is owned by a Canadian firm called Avid Life Media, based in Toronto. And they are being threatened that unless they shut down Ashley Madison, CougarLife.com, and one called EstablishedMen.com, that the Impact Team is going to expose some or all of those 37 million members and their data on what their sexual proclivities and fantasies are. So here comes the ultimatum from this authoritarian group, the Impact Team. Avid Life Media has been instructed to take Ashley Madison and Established Men offline permanently in all forms, or we will release all customer records, including profiles with all the customers' secret sexual fantasies and matching credit card transaction, real names and addresses, and employee documents and emails. The other websites may stay online. Now, who the hell put the Impact Team in charge of all this? Well, it seems that what really offended the Impact Team is not so much the sexual behavior that might violate some people's, religious or personal values, but because Ashley Madison has been making over $1 million a year from what the Impact Group thinks is a false service. And that is, if you've been a member of Ashley Madison and then you think better of it and you want to have a full delete of all your data, you have to pay them an extra $19 to destroy the evidence that you were an Ashley Madison member. And apparently, the people at the Impact Team have enough data to show that when you pay the $19, Ashley Madison doesn't actually delete all your information. And what the manifesto reads is, full delete netted ALM $1.7 million in revenue in 2014. It's also a complete lie. So, if you're an Ashley Madison subscriber, you might prepare to be exposed. Because I can't imagine that Ashley Madison is going to knuckle under to this ultimatum. And it looks like the Impact Group is serious about going forward with exposing all of those people. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.